This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. You just heard my conversation with Elizabeth Gilpin about her memoir, Stolen, which chronicles her abuse at the hands of a boarding school for troubled teenagers. Many of these kinds of programs actually have roots in a West Coast cult called Synanon, where children are separated from their parents at 6 months old and then raised by the community. One survivor of this cult is Mikel Jolay, who you might know as the frontman of the indie rock band The Toxic Airborne Event. Mikel fled the cult with his mom when he was five, but as he learned, you can physically leave a place, but the experiences will stay with you. Mikel spent part of his childhood raised by his mother, a highly intelligent woman who struggled to keep a grip on reality, which often included not feeding her children properly. He spent his teenage years in L.A. with his father, a recovering heroin addict and devoted dad who was convinced his son was destined for great things. Through it all, Mikel struggled to forge his own path, attempting to escape the family legacy of poverty and addiction without leaving his father and brother behind. Last year, Mikel shared the story of his turbulent formative years in musical and written form. His memoir is titled Hollywood Park, and he and his band, The Airborne Toxic Event, released a new album to accompany the book, also titled Hollywood Park. I spoke with Mikel back in May of last year, and I had noticed that in early press for the book, it seemed he was still a little bit uncomfortable talking about what he'd written. So I began our conversation by asking him what he found surprisingly challenging about being interviewed about this intimate book that he wrote.
Well, I don't think yet all of us have much perspective on our own lives. You know, we're so close to it. And so much of my life has been trying to hide a lot of this stuff or create this mask. I think we all sort of pick and choose elements of our narrative and our backstory that we're going to present to the world, particularly people who are, you know, you have a job or maybe you're in college or whatever it is, and you decide, okay, we're going to kind of brush over these years. We're going to emphasize these years. And so you sort of create a picture of a person that you present to the world. And that's something I've been doing since I was about 12. And a lot of what this book was going back and writing and giving a voice to this child that I was, that never had a voice for all the reasons that you laid out so well just now. We just never really had a voice. And so I guess, you know, I'm used to sort of interacting in the public setting. I've been a writer and musician for a lot of years now. It's this very sort of like the certain person that I created, I guess. And so to pull the veil aside and be like, oh yeah, that's all like totally my life. It's weird to hear it all at once because it all seems so awful. I don't mean to be sort of like too light about it, but it, you know, I feel like to see it all at once sometimes is really hard because it's like, oh man, that's all true. Ooh, there's a reason why I didn't talk about this stuff. But then, you know, the artist in you, the writer in you, for those of you who are listening who are writers, or musicians or painters or artists of some sort, I think you'll understand. There's like this bully that's like, make the art, make it great, get the story. And you don't even think about the individual, the persona, the identity, the personhood that is making it or how they might feel, which in this case, extremely exposed when it comes out. All you're thinking about is how do you tell the best story? How do you make the best painting or the best song? And that side of you, you know, that's the artist.
What did have to happen in your life before you were ready to write this memoir?
So my dad and I were very close by the time we became, you know, somewhat estranged from him as a small child. And then he kind of got into my life around 6 years old, and I spent my childhood visiting him, and then very, very influential on my life. You know, he's a loving, kind, warm guy with this crazy backstory. He'd been a heroin addict, he'd been in prison, but all that was before I was born. So he was always kind of the Steve McQueen, Cool Hand Luke, Clint Eastwood type figure to us as kids. You know, we were the boys of a single mother. And I think for the boys of a single mother, like you, there's this thing, there's almost mystical thing about men because you don't really know men. Mm-hmm. And you sort of know you're going to become one someday, this mystical beast called a man that you don't live with. And you know, maybe probably too much how important finding one is to your mother, which I think then gives you sort of a view. You know, it means a partner, it means a friend, it means, you know, this vague other thing you can't quite put your finger on because you're too young to understand. And so our dad was this thing that we just sort of worshipped from afar for being like this cowboy, almost like Pirates of Penzance, charming, one step in front of the law type figure, you know. And we would trade stories about the time he escaped from Mexican prison or the time that he slid across the U.S.-Mexico border on his motorcycle, always making a joke. always, you know, a little too much in the drinking and the drugs, always with some woman or another kind of in the corner, just hoping he'll pull it together. And I think this was our idea of manhood for like a long time. And we started to go down that road ourselves because we were angry children for all the reasons, you know, that you listed so well. And we were so mad, and we were rebels, you know. By the time we were 11, 12 years old, we were drinking and getting high and smoking cigarettes and destroying property and ditching school and just doing all the stuff that angry kids do. And my dad pulled me aside, and he said, you know, he took me to Hollywood Park, which is where a lot of the book is set. It's a racetrack that's no longer around anymore in Los Angeles, in this dirty, forgotten corner of town that my dad loved to go to. And he took me there, and he said, you know, you don't have to be like me. You know, we tell these stories, but they're awful. Being an addict is awful. Going to prison is awful. And he said, you know, you're a smart kid. I want something more for you. And it kind of twisted and changed my idea of manhood, you know, I think, and that I can go and become something else. I don't have to go become this thing, which he very much wanted for me. And then he quit his job and was home. And he also got sick around that time, so I think that's part of why he quit his job. But he wanted to take care of me. And my stepmom, although we don't use the S word in our family, so I'll just say my mom, Bonnie, she worked. And here's this masculine guy who works on trucks and likes football and baseball and, you know, did time and all that kind of stuff, who's proud of his wife for being the breadwinner and is home, so he's there for me after school, and he washes dishes and cooks dinner every night and just takes on this other role. And it really expanded my idea of what a man was and what it meant to be a man, which to me started to mean, like, you take care of people, you take care of your kids, you honor your wife. And it really sort of changed my life. And because of that, I would say I was able to have a sort of a steady home and become I ended up going to a really good college, probably because of his support and because of my mom, Bonnie's support. And so anyway, so we were very close. And then about 5 years ago, he died. And it just hit me so hard, you know, and just, I don't know if you've ever lost someone really close to you, but grief isn't just sad. It's baffling. It's confusing. Mm-hmm. And I was just confused. You know, he'd been sick for a while, and I knew he was going to die, and I knew I'd be sad, but I didn't realize how much it would feel like this tear and the fabric of time and physics. And it was just like I remember thinking, like, what's next, gravity? Like, I just couldn't comprehend a world without him. And so I went about 9 months just being very depressed, and I'd been on the road for 8 years with the band, and I just came to, and I just decided, like, I got to write a book, and I got to start to understand all these things that led to why this thing was so baffling, and, you know, why he was the first person I ever trusted, why it changed my life, and what the very specific events were. You know, he was in prison, he was an addict, he got out, he joined a rehab place that was a commune, it became a cult. That's where he met my mom. It was a political speech activist. It turned violent. We had to escape. We worshiped him as children. All of these things went into why it was so baffling when he died, because the whole point was, from day one, he was my model for manhood, my model for what it meant to be good in the world, and my best friend.
The first few chapters of Hollywood Park are written from the perspective of a child rather than an adult looking back at childhood. Why did you want to start the book with this tone?
I thought that, you know, it would be more alive to put the reader inside the mind of a child, and particularly children who've undergone trauma, I think, have really active imaginations, you know, and that to concern yourself with this worldview and to probe it and to think about it, you know, what's mystical about this? What's metaphorical about this? What did we get wrong? How did this look from the purview of a child, that these things would not only make for, you know, these are all kind of literary conventions, magical realism. There's very little magical realism in memoir, but there's a bunch of magical realism in this book. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a bunch of shifting perspectives. There's an unreliable narrator, which is like the big verboten thing in memoir. And, you know, I say things that are patently false. And it's because I believed them. I believed things that weren't true. And I wanted the reader to go on the journey of me of discovering which was the truth and which were the lies. Because that's how it felt. That's the actual, the journey that I went on. And as I was writing it, I came to understand that this also reflects the journey of traumatized and abused children. You know, you believe all these lies. And if you're lucky, as you grow old, you start to realize that they're lies, and you start to define that truth for yourself. And, you know, at some point for me, that included retelling the story from the perspective of the child who never got a voice at the time.
My guest is Mikhail Jolet. We're talking about his new memoir, Hollywood Park. You know, sometimes children see truths that adults don't because they don't have any cultural influence. They just see it from this very pure place. And a lot of this book is about parenting and what it means to be a parent beyond biology. What did you learn as a little kid from Synanon and from your time outside of Synanon when you were very young about what it means to be a parent?
Yeah, we didn't have parents, so it was all very baffling. So it takes a little context, and but the Synanon became a cult, and they had this idea. The leader had this idea that the children shouldn't be raised by their parents. It was just like, you know, he'd always say they're just going to mess them up. This is all just a bunch of drug addicts and thieves, and you've got all of your baggage. And if you raise your own kids, you're just going to pass that on. That was his idea. But I think anyone who studies cults knows that what it really was that your first allegiance had to be to him and to the society. Mm-hmm. So there couldn't be a family unit. And so all the kids at 6 months old, we were taken away from our folks, and we were put into an orphanage. And that's where we lived. You know, we saw our parents every few weeks, and we didn't know what it meant to have parents. Mm-hmm. We were always told, and you know, everyone's your parent in Synanon. You know, you're a child of the universe. You know, or they'd say all these sort of BS things to get around the fact that we were living with strangers, and you know, there was no Christmas and no Hanukkah, no Passover, no birthdays. No toys we could call our own, no family gatherings. We were just in this orphanage. And also, I guess, not being told that's what it was. And, you know, now that we're older, now that we left, we left just before I turned four, actually. And my brother was about seven. Nobody asked us how it was for us.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody asked any of the kids how it was for us. We were always seen as like accessories to this other thing. And Synanon people are... The older generation above us were very clear about all the ways this devolved into a cult and how hard it was on them. No one ever stopped to think that, hey, you just turned an entire community of children into orphans. And so all of us sort of grew up with this huge amount of trauma.
Sure.
And there's all these stories that have come out. You know, even if it was the greatest place in the world, which it wasn't, there would be trauma just by separation, as we all understand now because of what happened. I think it's part of the national conversation now that separation for small children is extremely abusive. So even if it was a wonderful place, but it also wasn't. Almost every kid I've spoken to who was in my parents' Synanon was molested. Almost every kid was beaten. Almost every kid was ritualistically humiliated, neglected, locked in closets. You know, then you have all this sort of nightmarish reality, and meanwhile, there's nobody, because it's a cult, is talking to you about it. So there's never a voice. You'd never have a voice. I never once in my entire childhood was asked what it was like for me. Never once. And to this day, there's people I love very much who don't understand. They're still kind of in that cult because they don't understand just how damaging it was for us.
Part of what we learn in the book, you spoke so lovingly about your father, is that your mom was abusive to you. And from what I understand, you're not in contact with her. She had very strange rules around food. She wouldn't let you eat certain things. When you'd go visit your father and come back, she'd say that you looked fat. Do you have sympathy for your mom or any empathy for your mom?
Of course.
Yeah?
Yeah, I think I do. I think, you know, it's a complicated thing because you can't help as a kid to identify with your parent, even if they abuse you. That's one of the complicated things about abuse. That's why it's really so hard to sort of free yourself from the yoke of it, is that you still love your abuser, you know? And it's sad and it's awful and it's hard to think that that's true, but that's true. And there's a part of you that sort of, maybe if you know someone really well and you know the pain that they've suffered, if you know, like, for example, in the case of my mother, she was raised by a severely alcoholic woman, was raised, sort of abandoned herself. She was raised in Holland in this house with, her parents were always gone, so she was raised by the nanny. When they eventually moved to the States when she was 14, she didn't speak English as well as everyone, and she was this kind of oddball kid, and then she ended up at Berkeley. Became sort of this rebel free speech activist at Berkeley, ended up joining the commune, and left her, and then eventually that devolved into violence, and she got divorced, and she was penniless, and she was without a friend, and she was on the run because they were trying to hunt us down, and witnessed a tremendous amount of violence. And you know, of course I have empathy for these things. It's, you can't hate someone whose pain you know so well. I think that the issue though is that it centers the abuser in the discussion. And it's like, yeah, I've answered that question about a million times. The question is, does she have empathy for us? And the question is, did she think about our experience? The question is, could she see that even now? Could she see that? And that question's been answered you know, countless times. No, never, not once. And so it's like, you know, I mean, of course I can. You know, and part of it, I think, is that there's some mental illness at work. There's a lot of depression and like severe chronic depression. And I think elements of narcissistic personality disorder, borderline personality disorder, you know, and this is all just me sort of trying to piece these things together. I think part of the problem is that we don't have, as a society, have a language for these things that are called cluster B, NPD and BPD, these things that create these fairly common disorders which create relationships that lack empathy, that lack of an ability to consider a child's point of view, perspective, needs. And if you've been hurt by a parent, there's a part of you always wishes the parent will someday see it, to truly see the pain they caused you and apologize. And it's a childish wish, and I know that, and completely beyond the ability of someone with NPD to do, because the whole point is they're not capable of self-reflection. That's why it's so notoriously hard to treat. But, you know, I'd be lying if I said, despite everything, the child in me wouldn't want her to read the book and say, oh my God, I had no idea. I'm so sorry.
My guest is Michael Jolet. And before I let you go, I want to talk a little bit about this accompanying album. Was that always the case, that you were going to have a musical component to this book?
About halfway through. I mean, I was really inside the headspace of this kid that I was, and I spent a lot of time trying to recreate his world even before I started writing, because you got to really get into the sort of visceral memory of sights and sounds and smells. And I did a lot of interviews and spent a lot of time in the places where I was trying to create the world. So I was inside this emotional, psychological perspective of this kid, and so I started writing songs from his perspective. And then about halfway through, I was like, oh, this should be the album. Of course, this should be the album. Mm-hmm. And then I went to the band, and they were like, oh, yeah, of course, this should be the album. And so we spent 2 years trying to make something like a concept album, I guess, something like The Wall by Pink Floyd. I don't think it sounds like The Wall, but the idea being that we, you know, try and tell a narrative start to finish. Some of it's songs, some of it's just little bits of music and static and real audio, and that you can get inside this story from the perspective of songs and songwriting, even if you're not familiar with the book.
That was my conversation with musician Michael Jolet about his memoir, Hollywood Park.